Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. We can't control the curveballs life throws at us, but we can control how we handle them. Asha Bendeli decided she needed to face the biggest one of her life alone. Cynthia Adai Robinson, star of the USA series Shooter, reads Asha's essay, I Need to Woman Up.
5 months after we were married, my husband, Rashid, and I had a honeymoon of sorts. A 44-hour jaunt in a trailer at the New York State Prison where he lived. At 21, he had been convicted of a gang-related murder, which occurred 3 years before, and on this day, he was in the 13th year of a 20-year sentence. We had met 5 years earlier, when I was 23, a college student teaching poetry to prisoners. I believed then, as I do now, that poems can expand a soul. They had done so for me, and I was watching the same thing happen to prisoners, especially Rashid, already a man seeking transformation. Over the course of a year and many discussions about changing ourselves and our world, we fell in love. With Rashid, there was this breadth of dialogue I hadn't experienced before. Our conversations, unspeakably honest, were for me life-saving. When I met Rashid, a failed marriage already behind me, no college degree yet, no direction for my future, I saw my life as a series of mistakes. He set that lie aside, made me see myself through his eyes until I could love my reflection. When I could no longer stand not being able to touch this man who had so touched me, we married in the prison visiting room. 5 months later, we qualified for conjugal visits, and in a small two-bedroom trailer in a yard on the prison grounds, we made love again and again. But more, we had a period of semi-normalcy. We cooked, danced slow, watched television, showered together. For 5 years, this was our life. The life we chose. I didn't tell Rashid during this time that I would never have a baby with him while he was locked up. I knew many women with incarcerated husbands did so, and while I didn't judge them, it wasn't for me. I didn't want to be a single parent or bring a baby into a prison. But I didn't say this because, at the time, I didn't think I could get pregnant. I had been married before and never conceived. I made love to my husband and didn't worry. Three weeks later, I found out I was pregnant. I never considered keeping the baby. Even as I wept, listened to Rashid's pleading, I knew I wouldn't keep it. It wasn't just the prison or my unwillingness to be a single parent. It was also financial. Whatever income I generated as a freelance writer and poet covered the rent, lights, and food, but precious little else. What did I have to offer a child except instability? Against the love I felt for the baby who'd barely begun to take shape inside of me, I had an abortion in a Manhattan clinic that seemed less like a medical center than a factory. Despite the doctors, the nurses, all those women waiting just outside for their turn on the table, it was the most alone I've ever felt. Though having the abortion was the right thing to do, I carried guilt about it for years. Had I been married under normal circumstances, I surely would have had the baby. The weight of destroying something that was created from great love was nearly unbearable. There was no way I could ever do it again. A few years later, I was on a book tour, celebrating what I felt was the beginning of my career, when Rashid and I were issued a date for a trailer. I flew home, armed myself with birth control, and never thought once about the possibility of pregnancy. I was thinking about what was next for me on the literary horizon. We made love and talked about our dreams, and when my period was a couple of days overdue, it didn't occur to me that I might be pregnant. But after 6 or 7 days, reluctantly, I bought a test. The stick turned into dark pink double lines that could not be denied. When Rashid called, I told him directly, "We're having a baby." I never thought not to have this baby. She created herself in spite of spermicides. Her presence was predetermined, and I was 32. I might not have another chance to be the one thing I always wanted to be, a mother. Still, there were fears. I worried about finding a stable job and childcare. I was terrified of going through labor alone. But mostly, I worried whether I would be able to raise a black girl safely in a world that seems to expand in its ability to hate and destroy. Living in a culture where violence is extolled and blacks and women are often stand-ins for the bullseye, I worried about whether the life of my girl could be honored by anyone other than me. The rates of drug and alcohol abuse among young people, the violence that's glorified in pop culture, the girls who at 8 are having oral sex in school stairwells, and the groundswell of so-called good girls out on the stroll terrified me. Not because I judged any of these kids, but because I had been my own version of them. Against a Manhattan backdrop, my sister and I were given music, dance, horseback riding, swimming lessons, and art classes. I attended private schools, went to the ballet, saw Judith Jameson dance, but it was also a childhood punctured by violence. All the education and culture were no armor against the excesses and dangers of growing up in an urban environment too unwieldy to notice its children coming undone. I began high school at 12, graduated at 15, and while I could put on heels and stumble behind the older girls, I couldn't negotiate the social settings, bars and clubs, where I found myself. On more than one occasion, what began for me as a fun night on the town ended as a date rape. There was always racism. When my child reached an age when she would have to negotiate survival, would she know how to speak to me as I was unable to speak to my parents? Would I know how to listen? And I had both my parents. My daughter had only me, and she would have to spend the first years of her life passing through metal detectors. Those concerns, more than any others, kept me awake through the nights wondering, where could I go? Where could I raise my child safely? I wanted to run, live off the grid, have my child, tell no one, keep her forever in my womb. But I had to stay connected to Rashid, even as my trips to the prison became more hellish. The prison guards, normally disdainful of family members, became especially awful once I swelled with life. During one visit, I had to request toilet paper 4 times so that I could please, please go to the bathroom. The love between Rashid and I no longer disguised the blight, the stench, and a terrible question took form in my head. As a mother, Would I be able to navigate the prisons and maintain my relationship with Rashid? But the rounder my tummy became, the more those fears either fell away or shrank to a manageable size. I gave myself over to reason, faith, Dr. Spock. I found work and childcare too. And I made it through labor, quite easily. My water broke a minute after midnight, and less than 11 hours later, my daughter Nisa was in my arms. 7 hours later, we were home, and I was eating pizza. 15 days after that, I was placing Nisa's body in her father's arms for the first time. He cried at the sight of her. And I wept too, but from the frustration of not having a place where we could be at the most basic level, a family. "You're such a good mother," my sister said once and then added, "How do you do it?" I heard this a lot during the first 2 years of Nisa's life, when I was writing a novel, working full-time, and meeting my deadlines. I told her not to believe the facade. It's impossibly hard to be a single mother. I hate having to be the sole emotional and financial provider for my child. The pressure's too great. If you slip, there's no one to catch you. But worse, there's no one to catch your baby. So somewhere among potty training, play dates, bylines, and balancing the household books, I lost pieces of myself I'm only now trying to reclaim. I started smoking again. I spent too many nights drinking wine and crying. There were times when pain threatened to define the whole of me. And no, I couldn't hold my marriage together. Caring for Rashid and Nisa at the same time was more than I could bear. The weekly treks through metal detectors, the parts of my spirit that always got snagged by the razor wire. I still take Nisa to see her father, but staying romantically entangled with Rashid when I most feel his absence was too painful. Every time I see her change, fall down, stand up again, I'm reminded that the only other person who loves her as I do isn't there to bear witness to her beauty. No one would ever lose an hour, as I still do, just watching her sleep. How could I live with that? "I can't play at house or marriage anymore," is what I finally said. "I love you, but I need to woman up and do this on my own." Still, in that breakup, I felt like I lost my husband, best friend, father, and brother all at once. And I didn't just lose him. I banished him. For that, I may never be able to forgive myself. But I had to choose my child. Again. Most mornings, I'm awakened by Nisa's messy kisses, her eyes ablaze with mischief and wonder. Nisa's query to me each sunrise is, "What's our big adventure today, Mommy?" I grin back at my beloved, my child, and my mind begins to work. But before I come up with a plan, this is what I think each time she asks. "Yes, beloved. Our big adventure indeed. Ours."
Cynthia Adai Robinson reading Asha Bendeli's essay, "I Need to Woman Up." We'll hear how Asha and her daughter Nisa are doing today after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After Asha Bandeli's essay was published 11 years ago, her ex-husband Rashid was released from prison and deported to his native Guyana.
My relationship with Rashid today is relatively distant, although not discordant. We've tried to stay in touch, but my life is one that is very centered on my daughter and hers on me. I've never kept her from her father, but her father's also never been present for her, and I wish that had not been the case.
Asha and her daughter Nisa live in Brooklyn. They visited Rashid in Guyana in the summer of 2013, their first experience spending significant time together as a family of three.
It was strained and it was difficult. There were moments of real beauty, but there were some mostly very difficult moments. It felt less like a visit than a mission. There was a significant disconnection that I and my daughter both felt from Rashid, and I'm sure that some of that was tied up to the fact that he knew that we would leave and get on a plane, and who knows when we would be back. And my hope is that as the years pass, we'll be able to do better.
Despite its challenges, Asha does not regret her decision to leave Rashid.
I could not balance the emotional and financial needs of my husband with the needs of my daughter. There would have been no room left for me to breathe, and I had to make a choice about who I was going to stand with. I don't think that I made the wrong choice, but I made a hard choice because I loved my husband very, very much. The guilt never fully leaves you. You learn to live with it.
For some people, finding new love can help you move on. But Asha says that just isn't a priority for her.
You know, love for me has been work. Love for me has been a lot of labor. And so it would have to be a very, very, very special person and somebody who was deeply grounded in themselves and self-aware and capable, because I don't think I can do the kind of work that I did as a 23-year-old, and I don't think I'm willing anymore to do that kind of work. And I think that what I want more than anything in the next phase of my life is peace. And so if love arrives with that peace, then I'll let them in the door. But if love arrives with a whole lot of drama and labor on my part, then that door's staying closed.
But Asha's life is full thanks to 16-year-old Nisa.
She's a brilliant, loving, giving child. And I guess I fundamentally believe that when we put our children in the center, most other decisions that we make are going to be healthy for society. So our house has been a house that has been filled with love and compassion and peace because she has been in the center of it. And that's worked out pretty well for me.
Asha Bandeli. She's the author of several books, including the memoir, The Prisoner's Wife. She's also co-author of a memoir about the Black Lives Matter movement. It will be out early next year. We'll hear from Daniel Jones in a minute.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, marveled at the lack of self-pity in Asha's story.
Asha's story really exemplifies how you choose your life. She chooses how she wants to move forward in this life, and she just seemed so strong for being in a position that could be viewed as being so weak. At every point along the way, she just seemed to sort of exude this strength of choice and strength of pursuing a life of love on her terms.
And Cynthia Adai Robinson said she got emotional the first time she read Asha's story.
I was actually raised in a single-parent household, a different set of circumstances, but I can very much relate to a situation that is not one that you saw for yourself, but kind of needing to pull it together for the sake of your child, for the sake of yourself. There's a real strength in that, and I am in awe of all mothers, but in particular of in awe of single mothers who have the most important job in the world, in my opinion.
Thanks again to Cynthia Adai Robinson for reading this week's essay. Season 2 of Shooter is underway right now on the USA Network. Next week on Modern Love, Alex Karpovsky, best known as Ray on HBO's Girls, reads a story about falling for a so-called manic pixie dream girl.
I'm not a nerd by any means, but I've never been cool in the classic rebel way. For example, I secretly enjoy doing my taxes. This girl, though, was cool. She could get a drink at a hopelessly crowded bar. At parties, she enchanted men with jokes and dancing and loud laughter. I could see the envy in their eyes when she left with me.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Extra help this week from producer Catherine Brewer. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.